Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the Arsenal Women Arsecast October Mailbag Edition. That's right, we are two WSL games into the season because we're going to pretend that the competitive games that happened in September did not happen at all and scratch them from history and our memories. Nevertheless, Arsenal still winless in their first two games, but I think a clear distinction certainly between the performances and the results. Losing at home to Liverpool, very unpleasant surprise on the first game of the season. Much improved performance, albeit the bar was pretty low for that, away at Manchester United in the 2-2 draw. And we're doing a mailbag edition. A couple more games before the international break, at home to Aston Villa on Sunday, followed by away at Bristol City on the 22nd of October before we go into another international break. So we've taken a lot of your questions on Twitter while that site is still just about a going concern. And I'm delighted to have joining me to take on the mailbag, Aidan Gibson, who you might know at Beltran's Old Mole on Twitter. Aidan, welcome to the show again. Not your first rodeo.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on.
No worries at all. I've always meant to ask you, what is Beltran's Old Mole a reference to? I probably could Google it.
Yeah. So when I first joined Twitter, there is a baseball player who I was really fond of, whose name is Carlos Beltran, and he used to play for my favorite baseball team, and he had a very distinguished mole. Like, it was very noticeable.
Because all this time I've been thinking of like the animal, like I've been thinking it's conjured up images of like a mole, perhaps like wearing glasses, like something out of Wind in the Willows or something, like some kind of weird literary reference. But okay, that makes sense. I had to change my Twitter handle because the person I named it after went and endorsed a far-right presidential candidate. So hopefully Beltran and his mole didn't do that.
I don't think he has. I mean, I wouldn't be shocked because baseball players tend to have some kind of, you know, politics, but I haven't looked. Yeah. So I'll live in that fantasy land.
Yeah. I kind of wish I hadn't done that either, but there we go. Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. I was going to do like a little bit of preamble about the first couple of games of the season, but the questions, as ever, really, really follow themes that I think we were going to explore anyway. And that's what I really like about these mailbags. Like, they really, really tell you what the kind of fans are thinking, what they're worried about, what they're preoccupied with. So we're going to dive straight in because they follow some themes that probably won't surprise most people. And I figure let's start with the goalkeeper and the goalkeeping situation. And I listened to Counter Press this week and had a really interesting conversation about how Chelsea, Arsenal and Manchester City all seem to have fallen into this kind of goalkeeper rotation policy. United haven't, with Mary Earps, and considering the way she's played over the last year and a half, I'd say that stability has probably done her some favours. But we had lots of questions. Going to go with three of them. Laura Veen Comps specialist at Veen Comps. Even with that howler, I felt way more confident with D'Angelo in goal than I do with Manu. She collects crosses better and is a better passer of the ball while shot stopping probably isn't great for either. How do you guys feel about this? Ren Marv at Renegade_Mav. Has the rotation of goalkeepers shown why Arsenal reportedly went for Mary Earps? And finally, Catherine Donaldson at KD Catherine. Leipzig is the main reason Leicester are top of the league. Sinsberger and D'Angelo have performed poorly and cost Arsenal points. So, Aidan, what's your impression of Arsenal's goalkeeper situation, where both goalkeepers have kind of had a go this season and, to be honest, probably haven't either covered themselves in glory?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're seeing why Arsenal were reportedly interested in Mary Earps in over the summer, and why they'll probably go back in for her in next summer. But I also, so I think that, you know, on one hand, neither goalkeeper has covered themselves in glory in that sense. The first question about D'Angelo is interesting, because, like, I think overall, I think she actually did play. She played quite well on Friday. I was rewatching the game, and, you know, she was very good at coming for set pieces, which we know is a strength for Manchester United. However, like, it, you know, the first error is pretty, you know, pretty unforgivable. You know, pretty remarkable. The second goal, I think, is just like that's an error that can happen when you've got a new defense and a new goalkeeper who, you know, haven't played together in a competitive fixture. So I think, you know, I think on one hand, like, I kind of agree with the premise of the first question that, like, D'Angelo, I think, played quite well on Friday. If you take out the two errors, which is hard to do, it's, you know, it's sort of like, well, aside from that, you know. But I do think it is. I do think it is an area of concern, and it is starting to, I think, cost Arsenal points relative to, you know, the other top teams.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should say that I think the kind of idea is that when Arsenal want to counterattack like they did on Friday, D'Angelo plays because she's got big long throw. She's better at long kicking. I think it's the chance where Russo hits the post that comes from D'Angelo collecting a cross and bowling the ball out, which is why they played her. I'm with you. I know it sounds really, really stupid to say, apart from the two times I flew the plane into the side of the mountain, I was actually quite a good pilot kind of thing. But I guess I kind of agree. At the same time, I think there's probably just an element of fatigue around Zinsberger because she's been with us for 4.5 years. Whereas D'Angelo hasn't played as often, is a little bit newer. We're perhaps not as au fait with her flaws yet as we are with Zinsberger. But where are you on? Because Arsenal are trying to strike this balance, and I think Chelsea are trying to strike it as well with their goalkeepers, where they have, you know, different strokes, as it were, for different games. But then, like I said, I look at Mary Earps at Manchester United and her form over the last year and a half, since she's had that stability of being number one for England, number one for Manchester United. I mean, would you carry on this horses for courses approach, or do you think that Arsenal should really try and stick with one of these goalkeepers, particularly because, as you said, the defence is quite new?
I think ultimately it would be better to just pick one goalkeeper and stick with that goalkeeper. I think I don't think that D'Angelo's, like, short passing is so bad that, like, you can't play her in the games that you would play Zinsberger. If that was the way, if that was the route that Idavel wanted to go, for example. And I guess the sort of other consideration that I have for this question is, like, if Arsenal were to sign Mary Earps, I very much doubt that they're taking her out for, you know, a game at home against Liverpool. Like, I think Mary Earps plays that game. I think she plays the game, you know. In the alternative reality where Arsenal signed her, I think she would have started every single game this season. So I do think it does speak to the two goalkeepers in question. Also because, like, you know, Jonas didn't really do this his first season. So he has shown that he is minded to just play a number one. So I do think, like, I understand why D'Angelo plays in some games, why Zinsberger plays in some games, but I also do think that, like, combined with building a new defense, it would probably be smarter to just play one for now. That's where I fall on it. And because I think, like, again, like, I think it speaks to, you know, I listened to Counter Press as well. And, you know, the point that was being made is that, like, the goalkeepers that Chelsea have both have flaws, right? They, you know, Musovic, not the best shot stopper, you know, AKB, not the best with her feet. So it's sort of mitigating those flaws. I think that's true for Arsenal too, that both goalkeepers have flaws, and it's about mitigating them. And I think that ultimately, like, if you have a goalkeeper that you're 100% confident in, you're going to play that goalkeeper every game.
Yeah, definitely. I think it is a case of having two 7 out of 10 goalkeepers rather than a 9 out of 10 goalkeeper. And Zinsberger's best form for Arsenal probably was Jonas's first season, where she played all the time. And I'm with you. I think if the, you know, because ideally you just get a goalkeeper who can do all of those things, right? And that's what makes them a 9 out of 10 goalkeeper. And that's clearly something Arsenal don't have, and they're not going to get. I think you're right. I think they will try and go back in for Mary Earps next summer. And you know, that I'm not going to have a debate now about whether Mary Earps is the 9 out of 10 goalkeeper, because she doesn't play for Arsenal and she might not. But there's other questions as well around the defence. And again, in the last mailbag we did, this came out a lot in pre-season as a concern. And that stands to reason. Arsenal have lost their first choice centre-halves from last season. They've lost Laura Wienreuther. Of course, people are going to be, you know, I think justifiably concerned about the defence. So three questions here. Ryan McGavock, who is at Ryan McPhysio, who incidentally helped me with a tendonitis issue recently. Thanks for that, Ryan. Given the crazy injuries last season and the need to almost entirely rebuild the defence, should we trust the process despite a difficult start? Then Torquay Groundhopper at Torquay Hopper 12. What can be done about the defence? It's not clicked so far at all. Playing a back three weakens us elsewhere, and I don't understand the decision not to get a right back. Are we effectively stuck until Leah returns? And Monica at Monifacy 77. They say defence is the thing winning the leagues, not the attack. With our defence, I really can't see it. Is it just a matter of time and chemistry? So I think there's a couple of questions in there about how far do you think the defensive issues so far are a question of like time and chemistry, or how much is it a question of quality? And there's a question in there, I think, as well about Arsenal playing three at the back and your kind of thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the three at the back system, I think, was always going to be used away at Manchester United. It seems to work pretty well in big games when you look at like the end of last season. Like, it, you know, it really clicked against Wolfsburg. I think you can quibble about using it at home against Liverpool, but I think it was always going to be the system against Manchester United, and it sort of sounds like that was going to be much more of a sort of counter-attacking, counter-pressing game, right? Like, and so I think it made sense to play three centre-backs in that game. It'll be interesting to see, like, you know, whether that continues against Villa, because I think that's sort of, that will give an indication, I think, of whether it's going to be really the dominant system, or if, you know, we're going to try and move away and go back to sort of like 4-2-3-1. The question about time and quality is an interesting one. I do think a lot of it is about time. You just have to put in, and Jonas referenced that, right? When after the Liverpool game, he talked about the need to build relationships and having only had 10 training sessions with the full team, which I think is also why he used the back three at home to Liverpool, because it was the same players as last season. And so I think he was thinking he could get something out of that, right? That there is enough muscle memory from last season to maybe, you know, get that over the line. So I do think a lot of it is about, I do think a lot of it is just about time and building relationships. I guess I have a couple of concerns just about how they all fit together, how the sort of, Ilstedt and Kadena fit together, how they fit with the defensive line that Arsenal like to play, because I'm not sure about the recovery pace of either one. But I also think it's hard to make a definitive statement when, like, the big centre-back purchase that Arsenal made this season has played 58 minutes, right? Like Kadena made a first start on Friday. I thought she played quite well. I thought she looked, you know, she looked confident on the ball and looked good on the ball and was making it. And so I think it's just really hard to kind of make a definitive judgment about that. But I do think there are, like, so I do think it's one of those things where it's like, check this space in a month, which is hard because I think all of this is within the context of having gone out of the Champions League. And so now there's a lot of pressure on the league when you also need, you know, time to build relationships to completely rebuild, you know, the centre back pairing.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it might be a similar thing where in Lear and Hafa there were a pair of like 8-9 out of 10 centre backs. And I suppose what a lot of people are getting at is, have we kind of replaced them with 3-7 out of 10 centre backs? And I'm with you. I think Kadena is like the Havertz signing for the women's team. Like, it feels to me like a lot hinges on that. I think Ilicic was a good signing who plays the same role as Leah Williamson. Like, there's no, you can't really buy like a 21, 22. Like, it's kind of a relatively short-term purchase. And I think that's like as well as Arsenal could have done. With that circumstance. Kadena, though, like, Kadena is a lot younger. She's coming into that left centre back role where there's like much more of a vacancy, and that's the one that has to work. I'm with you. I'm not ready on 58 minutes to judge that yet, but it really, really feels to me like a lot hinges on that. And again, not to use the pilot analogy, I thought Arsenal defended pretty well against United, other than, I mean, the first goal, that's not a defending, like a defence, is a defensive mistake, but it's by the goalkeeper. It's not by the centre backs. And even the second one, like, the centre backs are where they should be. Like, Ilicic is exactly where she should be, but her and D'Angelo have never played together before. And that's a communication, not a positional error. So I'm reasonably optimistic that those things can be worked out. But I think I'm with you on the Liverpool game. I think if Noel Maritz isn't injured in the days before that game, I don't think there's a chance we play with a back three. I think that's a back four. And I think that was probably a tactical error, given that Liverpool clog up the centre, to take a midfielder out to have a centre half. And I do think if Jonas could have the time back, he might just play Lotta Wobbenmoy at right back and just eat it. Frankly, just have like a slightly ill-fitting right back. What are you expecting to see against Villa on Sunday? Do you think go back to a back four? Because the back three, again, absent the two Champions League games, is what we've played for quite a long time now.
Yeah. I keep going back and forth. Like, I think it will actually be a back three. Just given the threat of Rachel Daly, given against just the relative newness of Ilicic and Kadena to the team, I think he'll want, I think part of it will also want be, will, I think part of it is a desire to get Jen Beattie into the team as well, especially in this sort of period, right? Especially because, you know, without Leah and without Hafa, there's an absence of leadership at the back, right? And a lot of these players haven't played together. So I actually think it'll be a back three. I think it won't be a back three at Bristol City, but I think it'll be a back three against Villa. I'm not sure. Part of me thinks that it's not the best system to use against Aston Villa. I think, you know, I don't know how much you can take away from the game in May, because Arsenal just completely done at that point. But what interested, I was looking at some of the data and from last season, you know, again, this was post Wolfsburg, so hard to really, you know, part of it was tiredness, but like the data from that game that at home to Leicester was very similar to like to the data at home against Liverpool, and Arsenal really struggled in that game. I mean, Katie McCabe had a penalty saved, and you know, that was in the first half, but you know, it took kind of a wonder strike from Frieda Mornum to win that game, and I think that was a little bit more reflective of kind of that system struggling against a deep block. So I sort of go back and forth about whether it's the best call to use three at the back against Villa, but I think we'll see it, because I do think it's been used against Liverpool, it's used against Manchester United, it was used to Seattle the game against Linköping, it was used for a lot of the game against Paris FC. You know, I think most of it extra time, I think, was using the back three, aside from when Jen Beattie went up front. So I kind of think he's going to stick with it through this kind of block of games. That's basically what I'm thinking.
Yeah, yeah. And as well, some of this will be in the context of the fact that Villa are trying to do things slightly differently. So they were playing a very open 4-3-3 last season. They've moved more towards like a double pivot. They've been playing Lucy Parker in midfield. Jordan Nobbs didn't start their first game, came off after an hour in their second. And so I think they're trying to work out their midfield to be a little bit more secure. So I think it'll be really interesting to see what he does. I completely agree as well about Jen Beattie. I think he wants Jen Beattie in that team for leadership reasons. And with Jen, you kind of have to sit her in the middle of a back three. But at the same time, I kind of think Frieda Mornham, for example, we don't get the best out of her in that like box midfield. I think it's much better for her when there's like the double pivot and her ahead of it. So I'd like to see a back four, but I agree with you. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see a back three. And I guess like building on that, Belinda at Mornham, it's Twitter, asks about this since we're on this subject. Do you think Jonas needs to decide on what his back three slash four need to be and stick with it for consistency? And could the shaky start to the season be because of the changes that have been made? Not so much because of the drop in quality, but on the pitch familiarity the players have. So what do you, like, I think we're going to see Arsenal move between a three and a four this season. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think the bigger issue with moving from a three and a four is just how it affects those further ahead. Like you said, I completely agree. I don't think we see the best of Frieda in that role. I think that right 10 position doesn't necessarily suit her. And I think he kind of like, and I think also because of having wing backs, I think you need a little bit more ball security in that right 10. And I don't think that compared to the other parts of the game that are really strong, I don't think that's necessarily Frieda's game, but I think it does limit her. So I think that's sort of like, I think it's, if there's something about consistency, I'd say it's about consistency with sort of midfield selections and sort of choosing the two behind the striker. And I thought like, you know, I think when you look at the game against Manchester United, like it was much better in terms of the balance. I think like that was the other thing about the Liverpool game, like the balance of that sort of the attacking five was just off. And I thought that balance was much better, even when like, and it wasn't necessarily because like, you know, oh, he dropped Marnham and brought Pullover in and Little went out wide. Like even when the subs came on, that balance was still there. So I think that it's really just about building the partnerships in a way between certain players. And so I think that's, I think that's something that you can do, whether it's a three at the back or a four. I mean, I agree with you. I think we're going to be switching between a three and a four a lot this season. And I think like Steph allows that switch to be done sort of within game. So I think it's more about building the relationships further up the pitch. And, you know, part of that is like some of those relationships will be the same, whether you're playing three or four and with the two at the base of the box. And I think it's more about sort of just choosing the two behind the striker who fit, right? Who complement each other and complement also both who the wing backs are.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of tend to think when we play that box midfield with the right 10, I'd rather see Pullover there. The Mornham, for example, whereas if you want someone really central, like at the head of the arrow, I think that's Frieda all over personally. Just before we go to a break, because these questions are quite similar as well, and we've got one from Yana at YanaDW _, is there or should there be a vision from the club on a style of play? I get they're not going to tell Jonas how to manage specific games, but is there anyone who cares if we're going to play five at the back and long balls / crosses for the rest of the season? And Andrew Gambrill at Andrew Gambrill asks, what are your thoughts on squad rotation? Should we see a different lineup and maybe formation every game? And does Jonas consider the finishers as much as the starters? So I guess really what we're looking at here is like a balance between this being Jonas's third season. You expect by this point to really see like embedded principles, embedded style of play, but at the same time, kind of formation switching. There are five new players in, but we see Chelsea do that a lot. We see Chelsea switching formations and it seems to work for them. Like, where do you see a style of play first and foremost, I guess, would be my first question.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some principles that are obviously that are pretty obvious. I think most of them, though, are almost out of possession. I think Jonas focuses on that a lot. And when you look at his, well, I don't need to tell you about like what he says after the game, but when he talks about player performances, like a lot of the time, especially attacking players, he talks first about their contributions off the ball. So I think when you see a style of some principles, I think those are the principles that are consistent game to game. I think that kind of tracks when you look at the last two seasons. Some of Arsenal's strongest performances under Jonas have actually been in big games, and some of their less strong performances have been the games where you think that they should win, right? Birmingham comes to mind in the first season, Liverpool last week, or 2 weeks ago rather, right? Whereas, you know, Manchester United last week, again, I thought pretty good performance. You look at some of the games against Chelsea, since he's come in, really strong. So I think those principles of play are almost off the ball. So I do think that comes to some stylistic questions. I mean, I think the problem with the club dictating the style is that you're going to, it feels almost sort of like too, I don't know if the club can do that. It feels like really, it feels like overly joined up thinking. And I think you get into a position where like, you know, I think City do that. And I wouldn't say that Manchester City women have been the best coach team over the last three seasons. So I do think that there are some potential issues with that. With that being said, I do think that there are some, you know, I think there are some questions about like some of the principles in attack. But I also think there are some things that are pretty consistent. Like we know what his number nine wants to do, right? If you look, you know, we know what that is. And maybe it's just a case of like, you know, some of these attacking principles were not completely keen with as a fan base more than like they're absent.
I think that's completely true. I think that's exactly it. I definitely see principles and a style and the wide overloading. Like there's no inverting fullbacks, for example, in the Jonas team. Like they go wide. You know, Arsenal do. Matt Beard described it this way, and I think it was a really good like layman's term way of describing it. He kind of said that Arsenal do this thing where they start wide, they come central, they go wide again because they want to go wide high up the pitch and get to those kind of cutback and crossing positions. And I see wide overloads, counter-pressing. If you look overall at the size, the physical makeup of the players he buys, he tends to buy big physical players. Not always, like Cooney Cross, for example, Laura Wienreiter, but tends to buy bigger players, and players like Jordan Nobbs and Manu Iwabuchi haven't been his cup of tea. Like he likes physical players, both defence, midfield, and like you said, the nine is pretty much always doing the same thing. Like he's bought Steena and Alessia Russo. So we know, and taken Vivian Miedema out of that position. So we know what he wants to do there. I'm with you. I think it just comes down to whether you like that or not. I definitely don't see an absence of style. I think it's just a question of taste, whether you like it. And I know plenty of people that don't. Personally, I do. I'm a bit of a Luddite. I like direct football. I do think there are times in the Liverpool and the Paris games where we went too direct too quickly and just ended up losing the ball. But overall, I quite like the style, but I understand people that don't. I'm with you. I don't see an absence of style. I think it just comes down to personal taste. We're going to take go for it. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, and I was just thinking like the arched, like the sort of archetype of like an ideal goal, I would say is almost the Blackstenius goal against Bayern Munich last season, right? Where they were like, it was a passage of play with like two or three crosses. Like the ball got, you know, the ball, Katie McKay picked the ball up from a cross, from a deep cross, and then she put the cross in and Blackstenius head. And I think that's the kind of, that's the goal, right? That's the sort of archetype ideal goal where there's, the ball's been worked out wide. There's a lot of cross. There's quite a few crosses, and there's crash, and two players are crashing the box.
Yeah, absolutely. It really reminds me of the second ever post-match press conference we did with him after a Champions League qualifier against PSV, and Arsenal won 4-0. And he said, and he was asked about the goals and how pleased he was with them, and he said, "Yeah, but they were all quite Arsenal goals." And he kind of meant that. I don't think he meant that like in a derogatory way, but I think he kind of meant they were all the same type of goal. And he expanded on that afterwards, said, I want us to score from crosses, from counter attack. He was like, I want us to still score those nice passing goals, but I want us scoring from corners, crosses, counter attacks. I think the thing about Jonas is really he likes everything. That's kind of his style, is he wants them to be strong at everything. So he does want to keep a bit of that Joe Montemurro possession, control the game through possession, but he wants to have his cake and eat it, basically, is what I'd say. Whereas like Joe Montemurro, the archetypal Joe Montemurro goal is probably Kim Little from the short corner against Reading. Like that's your Joe goal right there. And I think he still wants to do that, but that he has introduced, I think, an element of directness and physicality and overloads and crossing and all of that. And I kind of think he wants it all, which is, you know, you could debate the bones out of that, but maybe that's also perhaps why people sometimes struggle to see like an overarching philosophy. And, you know, does a manager need like a real philosophy sometimes? I don't know, but that's stuff we can talk about in part two. We'll take a quick break and afterwards we'll talk. Got some questions, obviously, about Jonas's contract, for example, and we'll get stuck into those right after this.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Okay, welcome back to this October mailbag edition. I'm still joined by Aidan Gibson. And Aidan, one of the things that probably surprised a lot of people was between these two games and immediately on the heels of the defeat at home to Liverpool 24 hours before the Manchester United game, and I do think that timing was very, very pointed, Arsenal announced that Jonas Eidevall has signed a new 3-year contract. And question from Roos at RoosCH91, curious as to what you think about Jonas's new contract. Recall you saying on the previous pod that one of Jonas, Skinner and Taylor would probably not survive past the end of this season. Has the club taken a risk here? Similar question from Catherine at Agit Pro. Have the club taken a risk giving Jonas a long-term contract? What if we don't win anything this year? There's such a big investment in the squad and off the pitch infrastructure. And not winning trophies surely isn't acceptable. So what's your overall take on Jonas, first of all, signing a new 3-year deal, and I guess a little bit on the timing of it as well.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I think if you'd asked me this question on Thursday, I would have probably reacted a little bit. Just in terms of the time, I think there are three things that come to mind about these questions. And the first thing is that the club have done this before. They did this with Arteta. We lost 3 league games in a row in the spring of 2022. Looked like we'd thrown away top four. And I mean, we did end up throwing away top four, but we came back from that situation. So they have done this before. I think it's the club sort of, you know, saying, no, we back the manager. We're making that very clear. I think related to number one, there are a lot of players who have joined the club or have recently signed new contracts. And I imagine that there was some conversation with them about the direction of travel and what was happening. So I do think that that was just sort of tying that up as well. And, you know, I still think, you know, the point that you made on the previous pod, it can still stand and it could still be Jonas, right? Like if Arsenal finish fifth and don't win anything, he'll be sacked. And like they can still do that as a club. So like signing, so you know, the contract doesn't mean that they have that he has to see it out. So if things go really badly, they can still do that. I think my overall feeling on this is that there was a lot of reaction to the Liverpool game, which is understandable. There was a lot of reaction to the Paris game, which is again completely understandable. It's completely appropriate for fans to react to short-term defeats, and I know I have, right? But the club shouldn't react to short-term periods of form. They need to see sort of the larger picture. So I think for the club in general, right, the direction has been trending upwards under Jonas. So I think for them, it's an easier decision than it is for us to get our heads wrapped around it after, you know, after two losses, or, you know, a draw and a loss on penalties and a loss at home. So I think those are sort of like the two, I think those are my overall feelings, where it's like, you know, yeah, like obviously like the start of the season isn't great, but like clubs can't make decisions based on, you know, 180 minutes of football. Like it's not responsible.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you. First of all, on your first point, I think managers' contracts are only ever advisory, really, because they're so much easier to get rid of than players that you don't want. And I'm totally with you. I just if Arsenal lost the next six games, I don't think that'll happen. But if they lost like the next six games, he'll probably get sacked still. Like, none of the other managers that preceded him went at the end of their contracts. They all went before. Like, that's just kind of how it happens. I do think there is, I mean, first of all, yeah, the contract was basically agreed during the summer. And the timing, I think, yeah, was relatively pointed. And in Roos's question, there's a thing, because Mark Skinner and Gareth Taylor both have contracts until the end of the season. And yeah, it is difficult to imagine a world where all three of those managers are the coaches next year. But I think Arsenal kind of wanted to avoid the situation that City seemed to be in, where Gareth Taylor was in the last year of his deal all last year, and they renewed it after the end of the season in the end. And I think Arsenal wanted to avoid that level of uncertainty and say, no, we're going to, like, we just put this squad together. Just put it together for Jonas, the coaching staff and all of that. And we want to avoid this situation where the manager's future is uncertain. And I can see that. And I'm with you. He'll just get sacked if it doesn't work. It's kind of as simple as that. And I do think there is a value for both the coach and the squad to have that little bit of security. If he had 2 years on the end of his deal, if it was like 2025, I wouldn't do that at the moment. I think in an ideal world, you'd wait and see where this season's going before you do that. But I do think that from the club's perspective, there is something to be said for saying, like, let's not do any half measures here. Let's give the security and we can always take it away. Like you, I don't think it's really that final at all. It just allows the manager to do his work. Like you said, lots of new contracts signed, lots of players brought in. Like, I think it does make sense to introduce at least, like, not the illusion of stability, but some stability before kind of moving on from that.
Yeah, it takes away the question too, right? Like, that was the question for Gareth Taylor the entire spring, and the question for City, and he couldn't really answer it because he didn't know. And if Arsenal are in the same position, that's a question that has to be asked. Like, it's asked every week. It becomes a bigger question after a loss, right? So I think they've taken away that question, and it's an awkward question. And it implies too that, like, it also implies that the club is unsure. Like, I don't think City necessarily wanted to keep Taylor. I think if they'd wanted to keep Taylor, they would have given him a new contract far before they did. I think they just looked at the managerial market and thought, yeah, you know what? We'll give him another year contract.
Yeah, and in their transfer, I don't necessarily think this is a bad thing for City given all of the upheaval, but they also only signed one player this summer, and that's probably tied to the fact that they didn't know for sure who their manager was going to be until the end of May, and they still don't know who it's going to be next June, really, because I think giving someone a one-year deal, I think you either sack the guy or you give him 2 or 3 years. I think they've just, like, repeated, but you know, I can understand if Arsenal looked at Man City as a bit of a case study and decided not to do that. But I also think we've got to step back and say that the context of this was really that it was agreed during the summer, and how, of course, like, you know, opinions change as facts change, right? But if this was announced in July or August, I don't think there'd have been that much kind of, you know, that much noise around it, really. But that's, you know, that's another thing. People's mileage is going to vary on that. I'd just say, don't take it as read that he's definitely going to be here till 2026, because if it really goes the wrong way, he won't be, I think. Here's a question I think is really interesting. It's something I'm planning to ask Jonas in the next couple of weeks about ball progression. Again, I was looking at the data from the Man United game, and actually, as much as I think we played well and set up on the counter-attack, I think only about half of our possessions got us into the final third. And so this question from LPG at 1-2 post, with Leah and Viv out, we don't progress the ball from deep and through the middle via dribbles, long passes or quick 1-2s as much. Our midfield, which can do this mostly for defensive security, do you see any internal solutions in the way we set up to plug that gap? So that question about ball progression through the centre without Leah and Viv, is that something that would take time to work out? Is that something we might just have to suck up? Or do you see like a different way?
Yeah, I mean, I think it speaks to how irreplaceable Leah is in a way, and Paffaelli too, right? Like the ball progression from both of those players. So, I mean, I think again, like we have to see a little bit more from Kadena, because I think she has some really nice, you know, she had some really nice passes through the lines on Friday night. But I also think that again, this is, you know, it speaks to the style question we were talking about earlier, where like the, you know, Arsenal want to work the ball in from wide into the middle and back out wide. So I think you can see a lot of ball progression from, say, the fullbacks, right, playing into Kim or Leo, whoever's in central midfield. So I think some of it is just sucking it up. I think some of it is seeing a little bit more of Leah Kadena. I do think there are some, you know, I think there are some changes that can be made in midfield. Like, you know, if you want to think about ball progression, I think that's Pullover all over, right? Like that's something that she's really, really good at, especially if she plays deeper. So, you know, I think there are some internal solutions there. But I think also part of it is just like Leah Williamson and Rafaeli are two really crucial players for building up, and Arsenal don't have either of them this season.
Yeah, yeah. That's another thing that's interesting. You mentioned Pullover there. Arsenal dropped her quite deep on Friday night, and that was clearly because, again, they wanted to counter and they wanted that ball security. I think Cooney Cross as well, talking about dribbling from the base of the team, that's something she's really, really good at. And actually, you know, for Australia, they play like a 4-4-2, basically. So she only has that one midfield partner, rather, in Katrina Gorey, and she does like most of the ball progression for Australia. But it's a question how you get those players into the team, because I don't think Kim Little and Leah Valti are going anywhere. You know, does that mean Frieda Mornum doesn't play every minute of every game? I'd suggest that might be the case. But yeah, it's a question of how Arsenal bring some of those players into an 11. That's why I think we're going to see quite a horses for courses approach. I think we're going to have a lot of what we had on Friday, which is the team sheet dropping and going, huh, wonder how that's going to look in practice. And then after 5 minutes, you see it and you're like, oh, okay, I can see Kim's wide. I think I know why that's happening. And I think there is going to be a lot of that this season, but I think ball progression is a big thing for Arsenal, and they need to be careful not to become too predictable. I think against Liverpool, they certainly were. Here's what I'd like to call the copium question, because I've been thinking this a lot, but it kind of reminds me of like the Champions League qualifying stage, where there are just times to complain about things. And when you're on the wrong end of them, it doesn't feel like the right time. But this is from Brock Strongo, at Brock Strongo. Do you think the league might be a bit more competitive this year with more teams taking more points off the top teams and the top teams sharing points between themselves a bit more evenly? And will that mean there's a bit more wiggle room if teams have a bad start? And let's really crystallise this question. Chelsea dropped 8 points in the whole of last season. So as much as they did lose to Matt Beard's Liverpool on the opening day, they didn't lose many more after that. Arsenal have already dropped 5 in their first two. Are we looking at a league where the league champions, whoever they are, will drop more than 8 points this season, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think Copium is spot on, because like, I want to believe that Arsenal can still win the league. And I mean, you know, there are 20 games to go. Arsenal play Chelsea twice, so it's absolutely possible. Even if Chelsea didn't lose to anyone else, it would be possible. Arsenal would also have to not lose to anyone else. I think the next few weeks will be illustrative in a way. Like, I think for Chelsea, they always sort of start the season in this kind of mediocre kind of run of form. You're sort of like, oh, they look kind of vulnerable. Maybe this is the season where they drop more points and they just keep winning games.
Here's a stat for you. They haven't won their first away game of the season for 6 seasons now.
Right. And they won the league, what, 5 of those 6 seasons? Yeah. So I think that the beginning of the season will be illustrative. I do think that Manchester United and Manchester City will drop more points than perhaps they have in pre- well. United, I think, will drop more points than they did last season. City could drop around the same, maybe a little less, but like, you know, that's sort of somewhere around that kind of like 10-12 mark. The thing with Chelsea is I just think they have so many options to utilize that, like, you know, even if half the team's kind of out of form or not playing well, like, Emma Hayes can just make 5 changes at halftime, right? She can bring Sam Kerr on at halftime, and as she did against Manchester City. And so I just think that I think Chelsea will drop a little bit, maybe a few more points than 8. I think also because I think this will be like the Champions League season for them. I really do. I think that'll be their big focus. And I do think that Chelsea, like Arsenal, had so many players at the World Cup. I think there can be some vulnerabilities at the beginning of the season that, you know, teams that had players who had basically been in preseason for 2 months can take advantage. But I do think that part of it is just that Chelsea is just so much stronger than everyone else. So the next couple of weeks will be illustrative. Like, maybe after that, this next block of games will have a better idea. And I do think the middle of the league is a lot more competitive than it was. Like, I think Liverpool have gone up a level. I think Brighton are looking at going up a level. Leicester are not going to be as poor as they were last season. When you look at the relegation battle, I think it's two teams that have the potential to go down. And I think, in Bristol City and West Ham, I don't think you're going to have, like, you know, just the 3 or 4 who were involved a season ago. So I think the middle of the league's a little bit stronger, but yeah, I don't know how much copium I actually have.
Yeah, I think it will get just about into the double figures for points dropped, for the reasons you say. Like Leicester, I think Leicester and Spurs, for example, you look at their second half of the season compared to their first half last year. If you take the calendar year, Leicester City and Spurs, like, they're clearly, I mean, Leicester are literally top of the league, so they're clearly going to be a lot more competitive. Liverpool had so many injuries last season. I think they're going to be much better. Villa seem to be working things out. Again, yeah, Brighton have made so many signings that I think it's maybe why they've started slightly slowly. But they've brought in some real quality. I think it'll be around about 10 points dropped. But I do think, in a weird way, it's making these head-to-heads bigger again. because I think losing to Liverpool essentially means that Arsenal have to take those points, probably from Chelsea, certainly at home to Manchester United now. So I do think there will be a bit of a better spread of points. That said, I think Bristol City will probably go down with not many points, and that might be a return to what we used to see, of like having a very clear relegation candidate that nearly everyone picks up 6 points from. But then again, Arsenal, you know, like you said, we lost to Birmingham a couple of seasons ago. We drew with Yeovil a few seasons ago when they only got like 3 points all season. So, you know, maybe not such a bad thing for us. But yeah, I think it'll be a bit more than eight, but probably not loads more, if we're honest. And I might as well introduce it because you kind of referenced it there, but we had a question. I haven't got it written down, but I remember the emphasis of the question is from Big Mad Mandy at Dedo Park, who asked, is this the season that the bad thing could happen? RE Chelsea in the Champions League, the French teams don't look nearly as strong as they used to. Barcelona perhaps don't look as strong as they did. Could this be a season where Chelsea finally do it?
This one I'm gonna stick with Copium and say no, absolutely not. No. I mean, it depends so much on the draw, right? Like, when do Chelsea get Barcelona? If they get Barcelona, if they play Barcelona in the final, you have to say it's not 50-50, because I think Barcelona, I would say like maybe, you know, 70-30 Barcelona likely to win that. But 30% is a high percentage number of something happening. So, I mean, it really does depend on the draw. But I think looking across the landscape, right, like you'd say, like, I think Chelsea are probably one of the 3-4 best teams in Europe, and so you have to say one of the 3 or 4 best teams has a chance at winning the Champions League. I mean, especially because one of the teams that we'd consider historically to be one of the best teams in Europe, last year's finalists, are, you know, might not qualify for the group stage, and the other, and a semi-finalist.
All the cool kids are drawing 3-3 with Paris.
Yeah. It's which deserves its own sort of like podcast, like what Paris have been able to do, because that's pretty, I mean, drawing 3-3 with last year's semi-finalist is pretty amazing. But yeah, I mean, like, look, Chelsea was semi-finalist last year, and so I think you have to say it's a possibility. But for pure copium reasons, I'm going to say absolutely not. The Barcelona players who won the World Cup, they've got, you know, they want to keep winning. They won the Champions League, they won the World Cup, they just want to keep winning. And Piteous is back, and they didn't really have, and like, so they didn't actually have Piteous last season. So I do think that will make a difference.
Yeah, definitely. And they're doing this thing at the moment where Bon Matty really became the Alexia of last season. And now they've got them both. And what do they do with them? And they're kind of playing Mariana as a bit of a false nine. And I think they'll be fine. I watched them play Valencia, and I know Valencia aren't a Champions League level team, but I watched them play Valencia last week, and they just tore them limb from limb. I don't think they'd do that to Chelsea, and the semi-final between Barcelona and Chelsea last season was reasonably close. Chelsea were able to at least reduce the margins in that game, but you could still see who the clearly superior team was. But I'm with you, in a final, you can do that, and it might go your way over two legs. I do think Barca would have too much for them. However, like, that day is probably coming. And if you're Chelsea at the moment, you want Wolfsburg out. Man U and Paris Saint-Germain are playing each other, so one of them's going to go out. So, you know, there are a lot of big teams who aren't going to be in that group stage. It could happen, but I'd still back Barcelona fairly firmly. Final question, since we've got another game at the Emirates coming up this Sunday, this is from Max at Max_RXDWAN. Arsenal's record at the Emirates since the start of last season in all competitions is played 9, won 4, drawn 1, lost 4. Our record at Meadow Park last season was played 12, won 10, drawn 1, lost 1. Emirates games obviously come with the caveat that they tend to face the bigger sides, but is our record at the Emirates a concern for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was also brought up on Counter Press, like, you know, our record at the Emirates before last season wasn't great. I think we'd basically beaten Tottenham and Chelsea, and then we had all those Champions League games there, which I think, you know. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So I've not been to an Arsenal women's game at the Emirates. That's going to change this season. But I have been to one at Meadow Park. And I just think, I do think there's maybe an intensity that's lacking a little bit, right? Meadow Park, I think, is much more louder, maybe a little bit more, you know, so I do think that plays a part, but I do also think that, like, part of it just does come down to the fact that, like, the games at the Emirates have been against Chelsea, Manchester United, Wolfsburg, right? Last season, those are the games that we didn't win at the Emirates. Those are very good teams. But yeah, I mean, I think I do think it's an interesting question, because, like, maybe there's something about, like, you know, maybe there's something about just the overall size that makes it a little bit. It's just something as an adjustment. I know the players have spoken a lot about, like, this Emirates starting to feel more like home, but maybe it doesn't completely feel like home yet. But I think that's, you know, I think I think there are a number of factors. We tend to play good teams at the Emirates, maybe a little bit different than just in terms of the atmosphere and the environment. We know that the men's team lost something when they moved from Highbury to the Emirates. And obviously this is not the same thing as moving from, you know, Meadow Park to the Emirates, but, you know, there can be something that can be lost a little bit when you change venues. It does seem to me that, like, it's something that they'll just have to get used to, because it does seem that, like, more and more games are going to be at the Emirates, especially with, like, you know, 30,000 is your baseline number. I don't, you know, that to me seems like a need that's only heading one way.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's about 90% the opposition, but I don't discount the other factors at all. And particularly if you're Liverpool, holding on to a 1-0 lead is somehow psychologically, the Emirates a nicer place to do that than Meadow Park, when you've got, like, a really tense crowd trying to suck the ball in, probably. But I also think that's just something that will just go away completely with time. I listened to a podcast this morning about West Ham men, perhaps ironically, considering they never seem to let their women's team play there. But, you know, the guys from West Ham saying, like, actually the stadium question for West Ham men has kind of gone away now. It took a couple of years, but they kind of feel relatively at home there now. So I think, like, and actually over the last few months, we played at the Emirates more than Meadow Park, because we had those big games at the end of last season there in the Champions League as well. So, yeah, maybe there's something in that transition, and certainly we're very formidable at Meadow Park, but I agree that's probably as much to do with the opposition as anything else. And I do think it's interesting we're going to play Man City at Meadow Park, which we always seem to do. As well, I know that they chose to play Villa because they wanted to back up games at the Emirates as part of, like, the feasibility study. And you'll notice far less marketing and promotion for Villa, and that was, I believe, intentional, because it's about, okay, what does a relatively bog standard WSL game, when we had one 2 weeks ago without much promotion, like, what does that look like when we don't throw all of our resource behind it? And like you say, at the moment, at the time of recording, there's 4 days until the game and it's 32,500. So I think that should clock up to 40 or so. But yeah, I'm with you. I think, like, that will just diminish as an issue over time. But certainly the club has to do it, I think.
Yeah. And I think it's almost all to do with the opposition. Like, Arsenal had a bad record at the Emirates the first season, in part because, like, the games that were there were, there was a game against Barcelona. Like, Arsenal were going to lose 4-0 against Barcelona, whether it was at Meadow Park or the Emirates or, like, you know, London Colney. It wasn't going to make a difference where that game was played. So, like, it almost has to do with, I think, the opposition. But it's one of those things where it's like, you start looking at soft factors And I think you look at self-factors because of something like the Liverpool game, which in reality was just sort of like, that's football. Sometimes that just happens. Sometimes you play you play okay and you get the first goal and you go on and you win and no one makes a thing of it. Or, you don't get the first goal and the opposition have just, and then they score. And then all of a sudden it becomes, that's football. That happens.
Yeah, definitely. And I think hopefully a strong performance and a good result on Sunday. And we won't have that question the next time we do a mailbag, hopefully. But Aidan, I'm mindful of your time and with the time difference that you're about to go off to work. So thank you very much for joining us, and we'll have you on again soon.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Absolute pleasure. And we will come back with another episode, probably after the Bristol City game during that October international break. Don't know what that episode will be yet. Maybe another mailbag. Maybe we'll do something else. We'll work that out later. But until then, keep it at Arseblog News for all of your Arsenal women content needs. And for those of you that don't know, we have launched a weekly newsletter on Substack, which is written by me. And broadly, we put something out once a week on that. And I'll probably do some kind of Q&A on there in the next week or so. But keep an eye if you're still on Twitter or wherever on Twitter, on my Twitter, because we still do promote through there, but we'll promote a little bit through Substack as well, while the current owner of Twitter tries his best to kill it off. But he won't kill this podcast off, thankfully, because it's very much not in his domain. It's our domain. And with that, we'll say thank you, goodbye, and we'll speak to you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Probably in about 2 weeks' time.